The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. On this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast, I'm joined by David, aka Axe Annex, from the Bedroom Battlefields community and the Bad Internet Friends podcast, which he co-hosts with Ivan Sorensen of Nordic Weasel and Five Parsecs fame. And that seemed like a good place to get us kicked off, talking about podcasts.
Hey, do you ever find yourself talking to someone that you normally listen to? And then
yes.
You just kind of... just kind of like fade off. You just kind of forget you're actually there participating.
Yeah,
you're
like
just
you've
so used to listening to this person. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've had that. I've had that a few times. Like I've worked in podcasting quite a long time. So I've met a lot of people that I listen to, and yeah, in the hobby as well, even I've had those experiences. And it is funny, isn't it? Like when you, like you're saying, you hear a person's voice, but you're like, I could interrupt them right now if I wanted to. Like I could ask them a question right now. So, yeah. How long have you been doing Bad Internet Friends with Ivan of Nordic Weasel fame?
We just started in 2024 in late September. Yeah, so not too long. We're on episode 38 now.
Mm. Are you guys good pals? I mean, I take it, yeah. You've been pals for quite a long time.
Yeah, we got off. We got along pretty good. I joined the Discord before COVID started. And then when COVID was happening, we would often do chats together as a Discord group. So everyone would just kind of jump in and chat, and Ivan was there. So we would converse often before that. And then because I was always such a Five Parsecs from Home enthusiast, we just ended up talking quite a bit.
Yeah. So Five Parsecs, so you've been playing that kind of since the release of the game?
Yeah. There was a first edition that I wasn't there for, but it was a very brief period of time. I got in early on the second edition.
What do you like about the game?
Definitely the procedurally generated charts to create a very random story that you piece together in your own head.
What other games do you sort of play at the moment, if any?
Right now, I'm still gearing up to play some Battletech Aces, which is based on the Alpha Strike system. I almost got a game of Spearheaded on Sunday, but my opponent didn't show up, so I just hung around with some other people who were playing and watched them. So it was kind of like, you know, playing, but not doing anything whatsoever.
Is that a local shop or a club?
Yeah, local shops. It's part of a group called the Rust Punks that I'm part of here. So it's kind of like a club, but it's set in a LGS.
You've been going there a while?
Yeah, that one I joined for, I think it was 2025, early 2025. They were doing Mordheim campaigns.
How do you find going to the shop and kind of, I mean, I take it you're getting to know a lot of people, but I'd imagine you have a few games where you've had a few games with people you don't necessarily know very well.
Yeah. You end up playing a lot with people who you weren't familiar with until eventually you see their faces over and over again. Especially when everyone gathers in the beginning, the Mordheim group like usually starts off with like really high numbers. So maybe there's like 30 people there. And I definitely feel awkward around like large groups of people I don't really know.
Yeah. Aye, so it's outside your comfort zone a wee bit. I guess in this hobby, that is pretty typical for most people.
Yeah, especially because it's kind of weird to be there for wargaming with large groups of people, I find. Like, usually if everyone's there for a certain purpose, like you're all standing there waiting for a concert to happen, or you're just standing in line to get food or whatever, you don't necessarily have to converse with everyone around you, but because it's a social expectation.
Yeah.
With a bunch of other awkward geeks. yeah, sometimes gets a little funny.
Yeah, you need an adult there to facilitate it. to tell you, like, let's get started now. Yeah. How did you get into the hobby? Like, did you get into it in childhood?
Yeah, when D&D came out, I thought it was pretty cool. And my aunt was playing it, and she painted miniatures. So I always thought it was just awesome that way. I was too young, and my mom thought that D&D was satanic. So I wasn't allowed to play it myself, but I could live vicariously through others. And then we did some like board game miniatures gaming. And the really big push off I had was in the late 90s, my friends had gotten into Warhammer 5th edition fantasy battles. And they said, if you help us paint our miniatures, we'll buy you an army. So I said, sure, because I wasn't doing much right then.
That's a good team.
Yeah, I still have that army too. It's pretty great.
What army is it?
It's a 4th edition undead.
So a lot of metal in there.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of plastic for the 4th edition undead too. I imagine it was like early 5th edition where the plastics really started getting pushed, but it was like a really old plastic kit for the skeletons, horsemen, and infantry.
And is that like, that'll be like the diverse undead, for lack of a better term, before they split all into different factions? So you would have had like mummies, zombies, like the whole shebang.
Yeah, that's right. The better version, I think.
Yeah. You mentioned Spearhead there. I take it you at least keep up to date on the Games Workshop stuff, if not, like, play it?
Very vaguely. Spearhead's the only one I have any interest in. And that's just because the group wanted to play it, and I tried it, and I thought it was actually a pretty good game for Age of Sigmar. I've never tried Age of Sigmar, but people always said that was good, too.
Spearhead is a Age of Sigmar sort of spin-off, then, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's self-contained, where you buy the one box and that's your army. So it's kind of nice that way, because you have no creep.
Yeah, so they say. So they say at the moment.
Yeah, so far so good.
Yeah. No, I do like the concept of those games. I believe, is it, what's the name now? The 40K version. Is it called Combat Patrol or something like that? Have I just made that up?
No, I think you're right. Yeah, it is. They have those boxes too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I totally respect how they're creating stuff like that, because yeah, it's an immense buy-in to get into 40K or you know, whatever Warhammer is now, whether it's the Old World or that, or Age of Sigmar. Providing those games, it seems like a good gateway. And I guess, like, if you're going to a local club or a shop, it does make sense to play it, because you're going to find games that way, aren't you?
Yeah, and for Spearhead, I think it's unique this way, that they come out with like an edition, so to speak, of a box set. So the first one, you came with a little play mat and some terrain, and that's what you have to play with, along with some cards. And then they released another version, and so that's the one you have to play with some cards. But you could play with the old one. I imagine that GW eventually cycled those things out to keep you making you buy products. But so as long as one person's bought it, you're good to go. And that's, being part of the group is handy that way.
Going back to the 90s then, like, your pals bought you that army, you helped them paint theirs. How did it kind of go from there?
We got into 40K after that, I think, as everyone tends to. And then everything just kind of died off for me, at least hobby-wise, for a bit. I would keep scrolling the internet, looking at miniatures. Eventually, I had to start like saving pictures of miniatures on my computer. And eventually, I learned there was other rule sets, so I would start collecting those as well. Usually people talk about like that, what's it called? Not an exile from the gaming, but, you know, like everyone has that period of time. Yeah, that's the hiatus.
Mm.
So, yeah, my hiatus meant I just wasn't spending money on the hobby, but it was always kind of on the back of my mind.
Yeah. Yeah, latterly in my hiatus, I started reading the Goat Trek and Felix books, the Bill King ones. And I think that was kind of priming the pump for me to, you know, this is probably 2 or 3 years before I got the paints out the attic. But with each book I read, I was like, I'm quite tempted to like have a bash at painting something again. So yeah, what when can you remember when it was that you actually got back to painting or gaming?
It was when my daughter was born. Was the big one. I would buy some BattleTech miniatures before that, because I was finally lived in a place where you could buy BattleTech miniatures. And then the Robotech Kickstarter came out. So it was around the same time my daughter was born. So that kind of got me like excited again. It's around like 2013-ish. I can't remember when the Kickstarter launched, but yeah, so over like 13 years ago.
Yeah, so you've been back a while, a veteran. Tell me a bit about BattleTech. Like, I don't know a lot about it other than it's a hex-based mech game. And again, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to really divide opinion. Like, I hear some people love it and I hear some people passionately hate it. So what's going on with BattleTech?
Well, BattleTech's one of those games that's been around for a very long time. I think it's bigger in North America, maybe. They would release these books called technical readouts. So they'd be like just a mass amount of fluff on there, like every single battle mech. And there are, I don't even know how many battle mechs there are, but I wouldn't be surprised if the number was over 500. Yeah, so they'd release these books and each mech would have like a background story. It would have its like weapons loadout and stuff. And then they would write novels upon novels. So it's kind of like Warhammer that way, where you just have this huge amount of lore. So it's kind of, I think like that's the biggest part of BattleTech more than even playing it. It's just all the, like Warhammer, a lot of people are just really super into the lore. But the game itself is a super kind of a crunchy simulation-ish kind of game where you have record sheets and you fill in little dots for damage on each little part of the mech and you say what weapons you're using and you roll to hit for those. And it's such a long, long game that I've never actually played a full one with someone who knows what they're doing. Usually it's just like me and another friend will get together, but we don't really know what we're doing and we'll just kind of stumble through it and it'd be like 3.5 hours later and we'd be like halfway through the game.
Yeah. Is it one of those games where half of the experience is the anticipation of playing it and then the setup and the spectacle of how it looks before you start?
I think so, yeah, absolutely. But I think an experienced BattleTech player can rip through it pretty quick, but I've never been in that position. But yeah, it's got to be like a game of 40K, you know, you still are probably sitting with a couple hours on that game. In probably like the mid 2010s, they came out with a system called Alpha Strike, which they made as like a quicker play version of the game. So it still has like all the mechs that you can use. It has like little cards you can download for free off of a website called the Master Unit List. And it has all the variants for all the different mechs that they have, because that's a big feature of BattleTech, is there's like a million different variants for each battle mech. And you can go through those games pretty quick. So like a large count miniatures game for that might be 2 hours as well, but you're playing with, you play like, I don't know, 20 mechs per side, while with regular BattleTech, you're usually doing like maybe 4 mechs, maybe 8 mechs at most.
Yeah. Do you get a lot of painting done?
No, never enough, you know. Never enough. These days especially, I've slowed down quite a bit. My eyes are getting older and more tired, so I don't paint as fast as I used to.
Do you have a kind of regular time of the week that you get to paint?
No, I have the option to paint usually after I get my kid to bed. She's getting older now, so I would think I wouldn't have to be this involved with her still getting to bed, but it's kind of a wrangling system.
She should be putting you to bed and doing your painting for you now.
Yeah. She got those young eyes. So usually at evenings my weekend is kind of offset, so I have Sunday and Monday off. So I usually have a pretty good option to either play games or paint miniatures on Monday with no responsibilities. So that's usually pretty nice.
What, apart from the eyesight and age thing, what's changed with your painting over the years?
Definitely my standards have dropped. I'm more of a just kind of get it done with some popping colors on the tabletop, and I'm pretty happy. I think they call it the 6 feet rule. Mm-hmm. I don't really push myself to try to, you know, paint well or for display or Instagram or anything like that, like I used to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with doing it that way, but you know, your ethos is very much in line with mine. Like, I enjoy the process, and I'm not trying to, not that I could, but I'm not trying to win any competitions. It's just something I enjoy, but I also like to get things done as well. Like, it doesn't appeal to me to, you know, the thought of spending months on a miniature. That's not something that personally interests me too much. I like to see progress, as much as I don't feel like I'm rushing through it. I do like to feel like I'm getting stuff done at the same time.
Yeah, I want to spend about maybe an hour per miniature at most, and I'm feeling pretty happy.
What's your basing? Do you have a go-to basing technique for your miniatures?
Yeah, it depends on the game itself. So for my Alpha Strike miniatures, I'm doing the Vallejo spread, like the little basing texture that is jamming into the base. Yeah, that's right. That stuff.
I like that stuff.
Yeah, so you like plop the miniature in there, you plop in a few tufts and maybe do a little dry brushing. That's good to go with Ranges of Shadow Deep and other fantasy kind of miniatures. Usually I do the dip. So you put down a rough coat of textured paint and then some PVA glue, and you just kind of rub it around in the basing mix, which is usually a mix of mosses and grasses and little pebbles and things like that. And then it's just kind of done that way. So it's super nice and looks good.
You mentioned Rangers of Shadow Deep there. You played a fair bit of that.
Yeah, I think that's the game that most got me back into the hobby. So I'd mentioned the Robotech Kickstarter, and that was, if anyone knows the history of the Robotech Kickstarter, it was a pretty big disaster. You ended up with a lot of miniatures that were just tiny, tiny model kits. They're so tiny, like 6 millimeter size model kits. And they're very, like a weird combination of brittle and soft plastic. So yeah, it was super frustrating that way. But it did kickstart me into like buying more miniatures again. So I'd like hunt around eBay and things like that and started buying stuff. And eventually I had a pretty good assortment of sci-fi and fantasy, a lot of Games Workshop stuff, old metal and things like that. And then once Rangers of Shadow Deep came out, I had a nice home for some of those miniatures. But the fact that you could play it solo or co-op with just an amazing story to follow through really got me, the mojo rising, you could say, on miniatures gaming, and that kind of just launched me forwards, and I've been gaming a lot more regularly since.
Do you have any particular Rangers of Shadow Deep, I can't remember if they called them missions or scenarios, but whatever they called them, do you have a particular one that stood in your mind for the story or whatever?
I played through like the three intro missions quite a bit. Usually we'll do that in co-op with a group. So, you know, I'll say, do you guys want to play a miniatures game? And I always like to start with that one because I think the story really helps people. Mm-hmm. And out of like the three missions, there's a scenario where you have to move through the a watchtower. And each time you enter a new room, it's going to be like random. I think there's like a possibility of four different rooms.
Yeah.
Something like that. So you just never know what room it's going to be when you first enter. So the first one's random, the second one, the third one.
Yeah. It's a brilliant game. And you're right. Like, it's a great introduction to somebody too, because there's such a story there. As much as you're making decisions, it's kind of laid out, you know, the story and stuff like that, the narrative. So I need to get back to playing it again. It's been a long time. On the Bad Internet Friends podcast for a few episodes, you were talking about actually writing a game as well. What's the story there?
Oh, I just always feel like I want to participate in things when I get involved with them. So when I started watching a lot of YouTube, I just got this itch that I needed to contribute as well. So I started a YouTube channel where I did some painting videos and some battle reports and stuff like that. And I play a lot of miniatures games, so it was always kind of in the back of my head is like, you know, what would it be to make my own miniatures game? I know it's a super saturated market, so it was more just of a hobby project than anything. But I figured, I always say that there's this game that Nordic Weasel Games makes called Squad Hammer, where you could adapt kind of any kind of rule set into it. It's like every once in a while, though, like there's these games that have like really cool miniatures in the box set, but the game itself isn't very good. So I would say, well, yeah, you could just you know, use the squad hammer rules to play that game. And so I wanted to see, you know, put my money where my mouth was and try adapting that rule set to something that was completely different. And there was a game called Endless Fantasy Tactics, which is kind of based on like the Final Fantasy Tactics and Ogre Battle, kind of isometric battling game. So you build like this 3D terrain that's all grids with high levels, and then you play a very specific miniatures game on it. So Endless had their own kind of setting. And I always found it was like really hard to get into unless you had the miniatures and the storybooks that they produced. So well, there wasn't like really just like a base game for it. So I thought, you know, what if I just mash these two together to create this kind of like generic, anyone who has like Dungeons & Dragons miniatures could play kind of game.
How did you find the process?
Pretty good, pretty easy. But also very hard, because sometimes I have a difficult time explaining myself, and it also comes through in writing. So there's like been certain hurdles I've had a hard time with. I guess some feedback, like how do you actually create your, what I call a guild? So it's based off of like an adventurer's guild. Like how do you actually create that? So I tried to explain it. You know, you need this many units from this kind of style and this many units from this kind of style. And people just got kind of confused. So that's the biggest hurdle. But for actually making a playable game, I guess, because I have such a wide experience of different game systems, it was pretty easy to pull influences in a cohesive way. So the game itself plays quite well.
You had Ivan on tap as well to help you, maybe? Like, did you get to tap him up for advice?
No, so far I haven't asked him for any feedback. Yeah, I figured I better keep it isolated to myself for now at least.
Should have used the podcast for that. Ivan, we're going to talk about my game for an hour and you could answer some questions and give me free coaching.
Yeah, we did do one episode on Endless Hammer. But yeah, I didn't really want to. It's kind of like a proving point for me, because I always felt like maybe if he had done more print-on-demand releases for some of his other games, they could have been a little bit more successful. So I thought, if I could get this to the point where I could release it as a print-on-demand, just to, you know, get through that whole journey, I could also offer advice, you know, like maybe where we could go with some of his titles that don't get out there as much.
How close are you to that point now?
I feel like I'm still quite a ways off, because I have zero formatting experience. So just like kind of make a presentable layout is super difficult. And then art-wise, I feel like you need at least some art that looks good to help sell your product. So like I have to kind of work on that one next. And I figure I'll just do my own art. So I could be like some sort of, what is it, Sean Sutter? He does like every single thing.
Yeah.
On his games.
One-man band.
Yeah. So maybe I can be not quite a band, but, you know, a one-man show on this one. You know, writing the rules and doing the art and the layout and everything. So, yeah, the game itself is pretty solid, except for a few points where I just need to explain the process further. And then I have to get to work on the layout and the art.
Have you given it to anyone else to play test?
Yeah, I've released it online for a few folks. And no one's really bit yet, because the first version I released had terrible formatting. So I used AI, because my work is like super big into AI right now for building websites and things. So I used it to format the document, and then I released it again and I got a few more eyes, but I still want to reformat it on my own.
Yeah. And it just makes editorial decisions that you didn't ask of it as well. I find like I've dabbled in it a lot over the years, again, through my work. And yeah, I've like in the past, I rarely use it now, especially not for any creative projects, but I'd ask it to review something or fix something, and then it couldn't help but like change stuff, I noticed, even though I didn't ask for those changes. So I certainly keep it at arm's length these days.
Yeah, definitely.
When I was writing a couple of my own games, I felt an area I was getting not stuck on, but probably spending a disproportionate amount of time was writing and rewriting stuff as if I was doing a final draft of the book that was going off to the publishers, when I was still doing a lot of playtesting and still changing a lot of things. So I think I should have been spending a lot more time playtesting and a lot less time rewriting stuff, as if, like I say, it was going to be printed tomorrow. I think it was just maybe because, like, I am a writer by trade and got too caught up in the writing, but really it wasn't the finished product. I shouldn't have been spending so much time writing it. So
yeah, there is that, isn't there? And you think, I know that sometimes I think that, okay, this is it. This is definitely it. I mean, everything makes perfect sense. And then you release it to the other people and they're like, that's just gibberish. I don't even understand what's going on here.
Parsec's Diary is an audio journal bonus series on Patreon, chronicling the adventures of my 5 Parsecs from home crew, the Lucky Strikes. Follow this beleaguered gang of criminal scum as they're pursued around the galaxy by lethal cyborgs, xenomorphs, and budget ale-inspired bounty hunters. Parsec's Diary is available now on patreon.com/bedroombattlefields. That's patreon.com/bedroombattlefields. And now, back to the show. You mentioned a while back about battle reports. Have you done many battle reports in the past?
Yeah, I did. I feel like I did quite a few. And they never had like any kind of traction whatsoever. So like the amount of work I put into them versus the amount anyone ever cared about them was just astoundingly atrocious. But I did some Rangers of Shadow Deep. I did some 5 Parsecs from Home. I did PZ8. That was really fun. That was a good one.
Do you find when you're filming a battle report, are you still able to keep the game kind of fluid? Are you still able to immerse yourself in it and stay kind of involved and enjoy the experience?
No, you definitely lose that. If you're playing with like another person or a group of people, you can kind of hand the camera back and forth, because I was doing it kind of guerrilla miniatures game style. You know, you just grab your cell phone and you record what you're doing as you go along and then go back and edit it afterwards.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's halting. You have to always think about what you're doing. You have to remember to press record on the camera or just leave it running the entire time. And then worry about it, the battery draining. So it's not a very fun process for me, especially not that style. So I was mostly just trying to do it to represent games for other people.
Yeah. I imagine the hard work, as you've kind of alluded to there, is in the editing, because, you know, I guess anyone could leave their phone sitting there recording the game. But when you end up with 4 hours of footage, like, that's not a watchable experience. Like, you're going to need to chop it up and put some, presumably some audio in that maybe helps explain things as well. I don't know. Do you watch a lot of battle reports?
I don't really watch them, but I do listen, because most of my hobby consumption is like in a podcast form, even if it's in video.
Yeah.
Where I'm usually driving and I'll listen to YouTube, or I'm at work and I'll put YouTube on and I'll listen to people's videos while I'm working.
Yeah.
I'm a e-bike mechanic right now, so for bicycles. So I work with my hands a lot. And I'm paying attention to what I'm doing. So I just kind of listen to it in the background.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very nice.
And that's another thing. I mean, when you're filming video, I guess, you know, if you're an inexperienced creator, the audio could suffer, because you're very, very focused naturally on the visuals. So, you know, if you're filming someone on the tabletop and you're just using the audio from your video on your phone, like, that could be quite far away from your mouth. The audio is not very good. So there'll be that to consider too, if you're trying to make something, wouldn't there?
Yeah, or if you... like, if you want to film in like a nice place with good terrain, you might go to your LGS and you have all the background noise from the people, or like the music from the stereos. You have to redo all your audio afterwards, and then kind of lose like the flow of the game if you try to like re-record all the narrative.
Yeah,
that was happening, or you lose your opponent entirely, so they're not around in the battle report anymore.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the Hobby Homies podcast. I mean, I know they've done battle reports for a long time, but they seem to have gone in with both feet now. They seem to be making a really good stab at it with their stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I think their battle reports are top notch. They have really good camera work. They have a sound guy, Churchy. He helps a lot. So it's the two homies, Shane and Fox, and they have really good, they've been best friends for a long time. So they already have that natural kind of dialogue between each other, combined with like really good editing from their editor. I think really ties it all together.
They've got very good chemistry. I finally started listening to the podcast. I'd heard it mentioned, you know that thing where you hear a show mentioned for years and for some reason you just never get around to checking it out. And then finally I did, and they released one episode. Obviously they've got a big back catalog. They released mm-hmm. one episode announcing that they were stopping the podcast to do the YouTube stuff.
Oh, yes.
So it was like one episode, and I still had the whole back catalog, but I was a bit like, oh, I can't help feel like I've slightly jinxed this a wee bit. So
bad luck, Matthew. Yeah. Struck again. Yeah.
How do you find like doing a, cause you do the Bad Internet Friends live. How do you find that? Cause you're obviously able to solicit that live interaction with people, aren't you?
Yeah. The hardest part sometimes is like stopping the flow of the conversation to pay attention to what people are saying in chat. Cause that's the biggest selling feature of the live, is that you can respond to what people are saying. But sometimes you just get into a conversation where you have a hard time stopping and catching up. I would say that's the biggest challenge, but it's very nice, yeah, just to know that there's people there who are paying attention and talking to you.
Yeah. And no, you guys do a good job. And like Ivan's he's very eloquent. I'm not saying you're not, but like he's, you know, his expertise, and he explains things very well. Like I think you've got a good dynamic going on there.
Yeah, he's very eloquent, and he's a master of words, and I'm a chewer of words, and I have like weird brain pauses, so when I'm talking sometimes I just stop like in the middle of a sentence. I don't know why.
I do feel like that sometimes, like Ivan, from what I gather, he's Danish, so
yeah,
like
right.
I know the Scandinavians basically learn English from day one too, but like I don't know that, I mean, you don't call a Danish person a native English speaker, do you? And I always like when I hear someone who's not a native English speaker and they have a better vocabulary than me, I'm always a bit embarrassed about that.
Yeah, that's that superior Scandinavian education, as yeah. my Swedish mother-in-law would tell me.
Right. Do you buy much these days? Like, do you buy much new stuff?
I try not to. I have a focused goal. So my recent hobby spending I just did was to buy a few more BattleTech miniatures for my project, because that's something I'm looking for specifically. So I'm not just like impulse buying cool things. I'm actually, you know, targeting what I want to buy, which is much healthier that way. And I bought a playmat, which is like, I don't know why, but in Canada, playmats are just super expensive. So I've like held off for years buying a 3x3. So finally now I'll have a 3x3 to put on my table.
Is that like a neoprene mat?
Yeah, that's right. And double sided to get the most bang for my buck.
Yeah.
Sand and grass, which will be perfect, I think, for just about everything I play on the table when I'm
at home.
Where did
you get that from?
Amazon. Yeah, like there's no neoprene companies in Canada, and shipping from anywhere else for a neoprene mat is super expensive. So in the end, it's just they all work out to about the same price. So I just bought off Amazon.
Yeah, the old neoprenes are good. Satisfying to roll the dice on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a couple like kill team sized ones I found on sale, which are pretty cool for playing like little sci-fi skirmish games. But yeah, they're super limited in versatility.
And when you drop a metal model on the neoprene, it's very forgiving as well. It's
yes.
not like dropping them on the, you know, bare wood or concrete or anything.
Yeah, where they just bounce. I just miss the days of like a single piece of metal being like the standard miniature, honestly.
Yes. I like that. I still like that.
yeah.
Most of the stuff I buy, I like it to be in one piece, or, you know, I don't mind gluing an arm on here and there, but if I could get something as one big lump, then that's a big boost for me.
Yeah.
Do you have any preferences of like what your miniatures are made of? Do you find that affects the painting at all?
I don't think so, no, because I feel once I've primed them, they're all pretty much the same for me. Like painting metal miniatures is different from painting, you know, plastic or board game or, you know, Games Workshop's ultra high detail shenanigans. So they all have their own challenges miniatures wise, but I think the material themselves doesn't really affect me too much.
What paint range do you use, or is that a bit of a mixture?
Yeah, it's definitely a mix. I have some Reaper, Vallejo, my old Games Workshop. Some of my colors from the 90s are still kicking, oddly enough. I put them all in the dropper bottles to keep them around. Oh, that's what I was going to ask you earlier. You were saying once you pulled your paints out of the, I think, the attic.
Yeah.
You said, did you find that any had survived?
Yeah. Yeah, loads of them. Loads of them. I'm looking at them right now. I've still got like a good 15 or so of the old Hex. The flip lid ones, the white flip lids.
Yeah, those are the ones that survive.
Yeah. And they're, again, I'm very much a layman when it comes to paint and pigments and all that. But what I would say about them is they do seem to take a few coats to get them, to get a decent coverage on them. And I don't know if maybe, you know, I've got some army painter here. I've got some of the, I've got a couple of the two thin coats. I've got Vallejo. So, whether the modern stuff is just maybe demands less coverage or less coats, I'm not sure. I certainly have got a couple of Vallejo that are just almost like water, whereas I've got other Vallejo ones that are totally fine. So I don't know. Don't know what's going on there.
They are a little bit inconsistent that way, the Vallejo. Mm-hmm. Like some of the paints you get in the dropper bottles are just super thick. Like you can barely squeeze it out. I'm like, I don't know what's going on here.
And then my wee Duncan Rhodes one that I've got, I can't see it in front of me at the moment. It's got a little ball bearing in it, which is a really nice touch. So you give it a shake and it's getting a wee mix in there.
Yeah. Do you add any other mixers to your other paints, or is that the only one that you have an agitator in?
Yeah, no, I've never got that fancy. I've heard the folk doing that, but yeah, I'm very much a big old amateur plodder when it comes to painting. So I've never done anything too fancy like that. But what about one thing I wanted to ask you about as well was terrain. Like, what's your terrain collection like?
It's haphazard at best. I actually was working on a bit of terrain last night. You know, you can buy those like. For a while there was like a big trend to have like grassy looking terrain or like backgrounds in YouTube videos. So they do like these squares of like grass basically, or like some sort of ivy looking thing or plants or whatever. And they're all on like little pegs. So it's like a little hooked peg and then it's like a little plant like just jammed into it. So I had a whole bunch of different styles of those. So last night I just pulled them all off the pegs and like mixed it up and then like reassembled them again. So now it looks like, you know, like little grassy jungle terrain, basically. So like they have different heights and different plants and things. So kind of makes it look pretty cool. I like pre-painted terrain quite a bit because I don't know why, but I hate painting terrain. It's just the most awful, boring thing I'd ever want to do in my life, even though it's not that hard. It's one of those things where you rip off the Band-Aid and you can get it going, but then you just never want to do it again.
Where was the last place you bought pre-painted terrain from?
My local game store, the LGS. I was buying some Hex Tech, which is for battle tech. So it's a pre-painted terrain that's kind of in like the hex grid format. So if you set it down on a hex map, it'll line up perfectly. Or if you just put on a regular map, it just looks like sci-fi terrain, basically. And then, the buzz, like that recent buzz too, where Games Workshop is releasing their pre-painted terrain on sprues, actually sounds, you know, pretty exciting.
I want pre-painted clear L-shaped ruins.
That's right. If I wanted to spend like $1 million on terrain, I would maybe consider the Games Workshop stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't imagine that will come cheap. But
No.
You can't argue with the quality. I was just doing the newsletter. Like I said, I was doing the newsletter today and I was looking at War Bases. They do the pre-colored MDF now. So
nice.
They do some really nice buildings on that front. I like the idea of that. And you can take the roofs off as well and get your miniatures inside the buildings too. So that's a pretty cool option.
Yeah, the pre-painted MDF and like the plastic card stuff was very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a company that was doing it and then they went out of business. So it was kind of sad. What they call Plasticraft, maybe?
Right. I've heard of them, yeah. Then I've got a few boxes of the God, what's its name now? The cardboard stuff. Battle Systems.
Oh, yes, yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's really good stuff. And a clever idea as well, because you could take it all down and it stores away in the box. And it's obviously quite modular too, so you could create different setups every time you use it. So I like that stuff too, the Battle Systems stuff. Loads of good options these days for terrain if you don't want to or just don't have the time to make it yourself.
Yeah, and just a little bit of decent terrain and some, you know, half-painted miniatures or, you know, like something to pop the color really brings everything together in aggregate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like you get a play mat down, some okay terrain, some okay miniatures, and you have a pretty good time, honestly.
Yeah. Well, it's been a really good chat, David, and thanks for getting up so early for me. I really do appreciate it. Anywhere you want to send a listener that they could check out what you're up to?
Well, you can always check out the Bad Internet Friends Hobby Podcast on all the podcast sources that you upload them to, as well as YouTube and Twitch. And that's about all I'm doing right now. I don't really like most of the social media things. I have them, but I don't really like using them, so...
Yeah, stay off of that. When's your next live stream?
It is going to be, we do it every second Wednesday of the month and every fourth Monday. So the next one will be the 10th.
Good stuff.
And I will, I usually post on the Hobby Homies and the Nordic Weasel Games Discord with a time-stamped link. So if you are on those Discords, you can take a look at them and you'll see exactly what time it is in your time zone.
Yeah, get a link fired onto the Bedroom Battlefields one as well. I'm sure a few folk will want to turn up for those.
Well, thank you.
Massive thanks to David for the chat. I really enjoyed that. And please be sure to check out Bad Internet Friends too. I'll put a link in the show notes if you're looking for more hobby content in your podcast machine. And speaking of more hobby content, I've actually been doing some work on the Patreon front to bring at least 2 exclusive bonus episodes each month to patrons on the $5 a month tier. The first of those is available now and is a chat with today's guest David about the 15mm scale, Peter Pig's retro website and unconventional 2-brush blending. You could find that by going to bedroombattlefields.com/Patreon. That's bedroombattlefields.com/Patreon, and I really do appreciate the support. Alright, that is just about it for this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Thanks as always for listening, and we'll speak again on the next one.